Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. And she uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we all grapple with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Happy Healthy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Healthy Tuesday, Brad.
And I know where you are, but where are we off to today?
Well, today we are going to celebrate the bounties of summer and fall harvest to come and talk about the mental health benefits of sustainable farming. That's the big general conversation today. Because I have the good fortune of having as my guest Joel Salatin, who is a second generation farmer in Virginia, and their farm, Polyface Farms, is bringing what's considered America's premier non-industrial food production oasis, has been since 1961. And so I found out about Joel and the work that they're doing and the connection that the family has to developing emotionally, economically, environmentally enhanced agricultural prototypes. And he's going to explain all of this today. But the idea is that if we can bring our farming practices into more holistic balance, if we can help people source their food locally and be able to produce their own food, we can create a more sustainable life, but also a more sustainable sense of mental wellness and mental health and physical health. And there's been a lot of research in the last 10 years about this connection between the mind and the gut. What goes into the body impacts the mind. And there's more and more evidence that things that our most common mental health issues like depression and anxiety are directly related to the microbiome, to the health of our bodies, what goes into our gut. And it's interesting that we've can see a correlation between the increase in depression and anxiety over the last 50, 60 years with the same increase in the use of processed foods, highly processed foods, and industrial farming and big giant corporations providing food to the masses. And although it's been a very convenient way and a more maybe efficient way to get food to our growing population, now that we understand that there's a direct correlation between what goes in our gut and how our mental health goes, there's some concern that maybe our giant way of producing, mass producing food is hurting us. And how then do we turn the tide? How do we backtrack and try to become more sustainable and more connected to the community and to the food we're eating? And it's in many ways a very privileged thing because we have farmers markets and ways that people access, you know, small farming communities. But you have to have the money to do that. You have to have access to the more sustainable permaculture farming practices in your community. But Joel Salatin and his family in Polyface Farms are actually creating these networks or these prototypes that can translate and duplicate to every part of the world, that communities themselves can move towards this sort of practice and in some ways maybe pull back and reset our well-being. You know, back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, we were called the progressive era. And the progressive era in mental health care was trying to get people out of institutions and back into communities and actually back onto farms. They would take people who'd been institutionalized for chronic mental illness and have them work on farms and grow things and produce goods. And they saw that there was a great connection between working in the dirt and growing something and working with animals and mental wellness. And so this kind of back to nature, back to farm movement has kind of reemerged every few decades in our culture. And here we are with, you know, rising rates of mental health issues, depression, anxiety, childhood worries and fears and anxieties. And what you've never heard a clinician say in treating mental health today is, why don't you play more video games? Or why don't you go eat more processed foods? Or why don't you stay indoors all day long? Or why don't you spend less time being creative or being less active or being less curious? A clinician will never say any of those things to their client. And yet, that's how most people are living their lives today. Too much time in video games, on screens, indoors, out of nature, eating processed foods, doing those things that we know lead to mental disruption. And yet, the simple answer, the being connected to your food, to knowing how to process and grow your own food, being able to be outdoors and feel the satisfaction of being in a part of your food community, that obvious answer is one that's so rarely taken. So today, we're going to dive into what it looks like to actually take steps to move towards that back to farm, back to nature community that can help to reduce mental illness and increase our thrivability, if that's a word, in our communities. So this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and you can follow us on Instagram and Facebook, and you can leave messages or get more information about the show there. You can also visit us at kcbx.org, listen to previous shows, or podcast our show. Wherever it is you find your podcasts, look for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, hit subscribe, and we'll be there to listen to at a future time. So we're going to take a quick break, catch our breath, and come back and meet our guest, Joel Salatin from Polyface Farms. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Six lanes, tail lights, red ants marching into the night. They disappear to the left and right again. Another supper from a sack, a 99-cent heart attack. I got a pounding head and an aching back, and the camel's buried in a big straw stack. I'm gonna live where the green grass grows, watch my corn pop up in rows. Every night be tucked in close to you. Raise our kids where the good Lord's blessed, point our rocking chairs towards the west, and plant our dreams where the peaceful river flows.
Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And Joel Salatin, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you, Elizabeth. It's my delight and my honor to be with you.
So, Joel, your family has been farming in rural Virginia since 1961, and your father started Polyface Farms. And I'm curious to know what his motivation was to go to Virginia, or if he was from Virginia, to start this farm, and how it's grown to what you see as the future of sustainable farming. That's a large question and takes all the time that you'd like.
I can encapsulate, I think, pretty quickly. So dad, from a little child, wanted to be a farmer. You know, some kids want to be farmers, believe it or not. But you know, his family was not farming. His dad worked in a Chrysler plant out in Indiana. And so here World War II comes, and he says, you know, how can I get into this farming? I don't have money. I don't have a place. And so after flying in the Navy in World War II, went to Indiana University on the GI Bill, and majored in economics and business, and got on with Texas Oil Company to the Wildcat Ventures there off of Puerto La Cruz in Venezuela. Earned enough. It was a very high paying job. He earned enough money in a few years to buy 1,000 acre. And so we started farming down there. He had two boys then, one after another, my older brother and myself. And we quickly took over the local chicken market because our chickens were cleaner than the indigenous birds. And that created a lot of animosity. The local farmers called us witches. They said we were practicing voodoo and witchcraft because you couldn't have chickens this clean without that. And so when a junta developed in 1959 against Perez Jimenez, what happens when there's a breakdown of law and order is that it allows scores to be settled that wouldn't otherwise be settled. And so so at that point, we became expats. Dad was 39, lost everything he had, And instead of going back to the Midwest where he and mom were both from, so we looked at farms from about Lancaster, Pennsylvania, down through Virginia and into North Carolina, and settled here and started over. And I remember when I hit 39 thinking, wow, if I lost it all, you know, would I start over? So, you know, it's one of those situations, the older you get, the bigger your parents get. So when you start to understand as an adult some of the pressures that were on mm-hmm. their lives. And so, you know, I think we become adults when we come to the point where we realize mom and dad did the best they knew, and we forgive all the rest of it. That's kind of when we grow up. So we started over on this rock pile. And so dad asked, he got professional consultants, you know, how do I make a living on this small farm? All of them said, you know, plant corn, plow, buy chemicals, build silos, graze the woods. And his father, my grandfather, was a charter subscriber to Rodale's Organic Gardening and Farming magazine when it started in the mid-1940s. And so dad grew up with this non-chemical approach and viewed chemical farming as basically a drug addiction. You know, the pesticide chemical thing was an addiction. You were on this race to try to, you know, get ahead of it. And you never could. And so we didn't do that. And so he basically went to work off the farm. Mom took a teaching position in a local high school. She was a health and phys ed teacher and taught a lot of mental health in her health and phys ed classes in high school. And use the off-farm incomes to pay for the land so that by the early 70s, I'm now, you know, 13, 14, and the farm's paid for. And I'm getting I got dad's farming bug. You know, I wanted to be here. And I'm starting to scheme, how do we farm full-time? We were milking a couple cows, had a big garden, you know, basically grew our own food. It was essentially a glorified homestead. So then finally, I was able to come back full time after working out myself for a couple and a half years, got married, and we made an apartment in the attic. Teresa and I came back. I came back full time September 24, 1982, and we drove a $50 car. We lived on $300 a month. My wife, Teresa, was an avid, she could sew, she could cook, she could can. If we didn't grow it in the garden, we didn't eat it. I always said if we could grow toilet paper and Kleenex on it, you know, we could pull the plug on society. And we just hunkered down and lived, you know, frugally and carefully, started selling, developing to a larger scale what dad had experimented with compost, with portable livestock systems, non-chemical approaches to fertility, and mobile infrastructure, and began marketing. And here we are today with, you know, about 20 salaries that are generated from the farm, servicing, you know, 10,000 families, shipping nationwide. And it's just, I'll start crying in a minute. I mean, it's just, you know, we didn't envision that it would get there. We just wanted to farm full time. But what happened in the late 80s, early 90s, here we were, you know, a young couple on a small farm making a full time living without outside income, without a, you know, a Swiss bank account, all this stuff. And it started attracting attention. We were in National Geographic, the Smithsonian, New York Times, you know, Washington Post. And because it was such an interesting story. Well, that brought customers, that brought market opportunities, and you know, there we are. Then people started wondering, how do you do this? So then I wrote a book, and then I wrote another book, and now I'm, you know, 16 books later, and it's just been sometimes I feel like Cinderella, you know.
But Joel, how did you have time to write books while you were running the farm? And, you know, taking your wares to market, where do you find time to do all of this?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm a gifted, I have a communication gift. You know, in high school, I didn't play sports. I was in drama, theater, forensics, debate, extemporaneous speaking, all that stuff. And I entered essays, you know, I would write for fun. We never had a television growing up. We never had a television growing up, and we still don't have a television. Our kids grew up without a television. We read to them by the hour. We read all the old, you know, classics, so Swiss Family Robinson and all that stuff. And so in the winter, when things were slower, we're quite seasonal. We were a lot more seasonal then than we are now. But at that time, you know, I would do most of my writing, you know, and in the wintertime. Now I do a lot of it when I'm traveling on airplanes, because I can get by myself and not be interrupted and do a lot of that. But yeah, a lot of it's just time management. And I don't have a smartphone. I'm still stuck with a flip phone. So I don't have any apps. I don't text. We don't have a television. And so, you know, you can get a lot more things done in life if you're not, you know, spending all your time on the screen.
Absolutely. So let's talk about, I have two questions. One, where did Polyface Farms come from? I'm curious about the name. And then your family mission, what is the genesis of this idea that you're going to develop environmentally, economically, emotionally enhancing agricultural prototypes and then facilitate their duplication throughout the world? That is such a giant chunk, and I'd like you to kind of break that down.
Dissect it a little bit. Yeah. Yes. So Polyface came from, so I came back to the farm full time September 24, 1982. My dad was, remember, he was an accountant. He was a business administration. And so we said, well, we need a name. And, he said, well, you know, we can make it, you know, Salatin Incorporated. I said, no, I don't want my name attached to it, because this is bigger than us. It's bigger than our family. It's bigger than our name. And there might be a time when a non-Salatin is running it. You know, I had that vision big, you know, from day one. So I wanted to be interfacing environments of water, riparian areas, forest land, and open land. We submitted it to the state, and there was already an interface in Virginia, so, you know, it got rejected. I was sitting there we milked a couple Guernsey cows. I'm sitting there milking the cow, and Dad comes in with a paper, and oh shoot, you know, the State Corporation Commission turned us down, and we can't be interfaced. And I'm just sitting there, I said, well, if we can't be interfaced, let's be many-faced. Let's be Polyface. We both liked it. We submitted it. And so we're the farm of many faces. That includes many faces, many enterprises, many animals, many people. You know, we just had this. We didn't know where it was going, but we had this idea of an agrarian community of eclectic talent and comprehensive production that was synergistic and symbiotic and not monospecies, monoculture, single oriented. We envisioned, because we knew that natural systems, ecosystems are highly relational. Mm-hmm. The thing that industrial agriculture does is it reduces relationships. You know, I'm an apple farmer, I'm a dairy farmer, I'm a wheat farmer, and it makes us think very linearly and reductionist, as opposed to holistically, that I'm just a piece of a great big beautiful majestic mysterious complex organism. And and so we don't say we're cattle farmers or we're chicken farmers. We're simply stewards of a niche of God's creation, and it's marvelous and it's wonderful and it's diversified. And how can we massage, how can we caress this landscape to build more soil, more water, more air, more human equity? How can we bring more information to it? So that was the genesis of Polyface Farms. Then, the initial mission statement was make a full-time living farming. It was very simple. Let's make a living full-time farming. Well, as we were successful doing that, you know, your life morphs. If you have an objective and you reach it, then you don't stop living. You say, well, what's the next objective? And so as we started developing traction, and I'm, you know, starting to speak at conferences and encouraging people, here, you know, kind of my recipe for things, we realized, wow, we're kind of onto something here. You know, we've kind of got this platform, this pulpit, if you will, to preach a different kind of gospel to the agrarian community and to the food community. And so we came up with this mission statement to develop economically. I mean, look, if you don't make a profit, you don't stay in business. Mm-hmm. Ecologically, if you ruin your nest, you don't have a place to live anymore. So it's got to be ecological. And then emotionally enhancing. You can make earthworms and you can even make money. But if you come into the house and it's not a happy place to be, none of it matters. And so we realized we had to be multifaceted in satisfying the money, the ecology, and our own social, mental, emotion. All that had to be satisfied, satiated, and flourishing. It had to be vibrant in order to ultimately be, you know, to be long-term robust. And so that's where that mission statement came. And then we realized, well, you know, we're really dealing with prototypes here. We don't have all the answers. So we wanted to be, these are prototypes. Don't beat me up if it needs some tweaking on your thing. You know, it's my little prototype. Okay. And you can refine it. I'm not going to be offended if you want to, you know, make some changes because you're drier or wetter or higher or flatter or, you know, sandier or whatever than we are. And then we realized, wow, this, you know, these basic principles work everywhere in the world with local customization. And so, so we realized, yeah, this is not just for our community and our area. This is, you know, this is for the world, and we want to be for the world. So we're very open source. You know, we don't copyright anything. We don't patent anything. We've invented numerous things. We don't patent anything. It's all open source. We have a 24/7, 365 open door policy. Anyone can come for a visit to see anything at any time from anywhere in the world unannounced. And so that's our commitment to transparency. And it's all mission driven. This is a sacred thing, and it's completely mission driven.
If you're just tuning in, this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. My guest is Joel Salatin of Polyface Farm in rural Virginia. And we're talking about the connection between sustainable regenerative farming and mental health and well-being. And so, Joel, the farm is multifaceted in that you have animals and you grow produce and you sell these to the community. But then I also saw that you have a farm camp. Do people come then and learn this, how this works? Is that another piece of this as well?
Yeah. Well, we have several infotainment kind of enterprises, outreaches. So we do, just to list them, several of them off. One is obviously, as I mentioned, anyone can come and see. We have about 15,000 visitors a year that come from all over the world and see. So what do we have that's formal? So the first thing we do, we have lunatic tours. So I'm a lunatic farmer. You know, my moniker is Christian libertarian, environmentalist, capitalist, lunatic farmer. And you would appreciate knowing that a lot of the orthodox conventional farmers in our area call me a bioterrorist. They call me a Typhoid Mary. And as that developed, you know, because we don't vaccinate our animals, we don't lock them in houses. So as that developed and our fame increased and the local conventional community disliked it. I thought, well, I can either be frustrated about this and just be whatever, angry about the neighbors, or hey, let's have fun with it. Yeah, I'm a lunatic farmer. You know, I don't mind weeds in the field when cows want to eat them. I figure probably if the cows eat them, she probably needs them. You know, she's not watching TV, so nobody's telling her what to eat, so she knows what she needs to eat. You know. And so that's where that has come from. So, you know, these are lunatic tours. I'm a lunatic farmer, and we just laugh. We enjoy it. It's fun. We're not frustrated about it. And people, it resonates with people. People love it. You know, they buy our t-shirts, you know, I want to be a lunatic farmer. You know, I mean, it's wonderful. So it's become a bit of a brand, that we've embraced. Well, and we now have the Lunatic Learning Center, which is a 350 seat outdoor three tier amphitheater that we do gatherings. So we do numerous gatherings. We've had everything from Chris Martinson at Peak Prosperity to this fall we're hosting the first Eastern conference of the National Association of Nutritional Practitioners, Nutritional Therapy Practitioners, and so. We have all sorts of gatherings here. They can have the best food in the world, and that works. So we've got the Lunatic Tours. We've got that. We've got summer camp. We've got a children's summer camp. We have individual tours. So we have Grass Stains Tours. One of our team members runs that as her business. So she's not an employee. She's a total, it's her business subcontractor. You know, we've got, 22 people here. Nobody gets paid by the hour. It's all by performance. And they all can have side hustles if they have a salary. And we encourage side hustles. If you see something that you can do to compliment us, well, we want you to do it and to have your own fiefdom. Everybody wants to be in charge of something. And so we want you to be in charge of something, you know, if you can do that, or if you can envision, if you can imagine it. We do the Polyface Intensive Discovery Seminars. We do 2 days. These are 2 days, six meals. We basically do what most people would do in a week. We do it in two very, very long days with no breaks. And just, I mean, it's intensive. But we go behind the curtain. We actually, you know, butcher chickens, butcher rabbits, build compost, cut trees, mill wood, move cows, move pigs, move chickens. You know, we do all the stuff that we do in those 2 days. So we have the gatherings, we have tours, we have the seminars, and we have the kids camp. So there's a lot. It's a very people-centric thing, and what we find is that in our culture today, people are literally, they're yearning, they're desperate to connect, and I mean, we even have a compost pile that we keep right near the that has really good cured compost, and we encourage people to stick their hands in it, to actually, you know, stick their hands in it and get it on their skin, to actually touch that level of microbial, you know, diversity.
Is permaculture a piece of what you do, or is it different?
Yeah, permaculture. Permaculture is a copyrighted term developed by Bill Mollison and Dave Holmgren, who were both Australians, back in the 70s. And we certainly, permaculture certainly frames much of our thinking. I've never done one of the full, design courses. I've taught numerous ones, the livestock portion. We are closely very appreciative of permaculture, and we adhere many of those concepts of stacking, water hydration development, diversification, letting animals do the work, relational complexity. All of those things certainly, you know, stem from the permaculture idea.
A lot of it feels like almost intuitive work, that if you'd follow what the natural world is bringing to you, that in some ways that's the right way to go. You know what I'm saying? Instead of trying to eradicate weeds or grow things in rows or keep animals in a pen, that if you follow almost their natural growth patterns, that it seems to be more sustainable. Is that on the right track?
Yeah. So You're exactly right. The thing that's important to realize is that 500 years ago, North America actually produced more food and more nutrition than we do today. And that was done without John Deere tractors, without chemical fertilizers. It wasn't all eaten by humans. It wasn't all eaten by, you know, we had 2 million wolves that needed 20 pounds of meat a day, you know, so a lot of this was being eaten by animals. You know, we had 200 million beavers, and that number of beavers ate more more, you know, they're not carnivores, so they were eating more vegetable material than all the humans in North America today. So, you know, there were these massive things, and so our first question is, well, how did nature do that? And so we're looking at those templates. If I want to bet on a winning horse, I want a horse that's won some races, and I'm suggesting that nature's template of animal movement, of carbon decomposition, the hydration of the landscape with the beavers, the symbiosis of animals, you know, birds following herbivores, the egret on the rhino's nose, you know, those kinds of things, rather than ivermectin, for example, or, you know, parasiticides to control, you know, pests. Birds follow herbivores. When you start looking at those patterns, they're extremely elegant. They're extremely relational. They're extremely symbiotic. And so our mission has been looking out at nature's template and saying, well, that's the racehorse that's won for a lot longer than Monsanto has been around, you know, a lot longer than the moldboard plow has been around. So if that's the horse that's winning, let's see if we can bet on that horse. Let's harness that horse instead of going out and spraying Roundup and, you know, endocrine disruptors and all sorts of pesticides and chemicals all over creation. Let's harness that horse first. Now, it doesn't mean that I'm against technology. Goodness, you know, a black plastic pipe, electric fencing, front end loaders, wood chippers for carbon development, chainsaw. Okay, I mean, all of those things are absolutely foundational to being able to leverage these natural platforms, these natural templates, protocols to leverage them on a commercial domestic scale that we have today. And so I'm not against technology, but I want to use the technology that respects and honors nature's platform, not breaking down barriers like, you know, like genetically modified organisms, where nature has all sorts of mechanisms to make sure that GMOs can never happen in nature. And like a bunch of conquistador pirates, we go swashbuckling in there as if all those boundaries and all those barriers are meaningless. Like let's just run through that, you know. And then the next thing you know, you have unforeseen issues that happen. We often, you know, we're pretty clever, and we can invent things that we can't mentally, emotionally, or spiritually, or physically metabolized.
My guest today is Joel Salatin of Polyface Farms. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist, and we're talking about the work of sustainability and regenerative farming and how it's going to be the future of our mental wellness and how the two connect. We're going to take a quick break and come back and continue our conversation. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
I'll be a farmer working the land. I wish I was a farmer to work with my hands, 'cause it's been too long a ride, too high the fare. Well, I built and climbed a mountain, but it wasn't fair. And I've been looking all around, looked everywhere. Well, I built and climbed a mountain, but it wasn't fair. It isn't there. Dum ta dum, it isn't here, it isn't there, nor anywhere. I'm gonna pick an apple right from the tree. I'm gonna eat the apple, 'cause it grew there for me. And it's been too long a ride, too high the fare. Well, I built and climbed a mountain, but it wasn't fair. And I've been looking all around, looked everywhere, to build and climb a mountain. If it isn't fair, it isn't there. Dum dum, it isn't here, it isn't there, nor anywhere.
Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And my guest today is Joel Salatin. Apparently, Joel, the very famous Joel Salatin of Polyface Farms, because we're getting a lot of emails into the station saying, Joel is on the air. Oh, my goodness. We're so excited to have you here on the Central Coast. So thank you, Joel, for your time. And I would like to, something I heard you talk about was after World War II, it became very important in Europe that families and communities were able to have food security. Can you talk about that change and how they went about making the European market more small communities and how that is important today?
So, after World War II, the devastation that occurred there, there was a lot of hunger there in World War II. People couldn't get food. People actually starved to death, even in Amsterdam and places like that that we consider today as being just incredibly powerful. So what happened after when the European Union started, a lot of people don't realize that about 80%, and don't crucify me for being off 1 or 2%, but it's about 80% of the EU budget is subsidies to European farmers, keep farmers business. And so there is, I've been to Europe many, many times. I've been just to the Netherlands, I think 6 times or so, but I can tell you that the food quality there is better. And there is definitely a sense of each of those European countries, we are going to feed ourselves. We don't want to be dependent on somebody else for our food. It's a powerful, social vibe in the country, in the various countries. And it's very, very different than here in the U.S. You know, all of those European countries, they have a food culture. You ask them, or you go there and, well, our specialty is this, and I've been there numerous times and I always do this just for fun. I say, okay, so when you say America, what do you think of as America food culture? And in every single time, every single answer has been McDonald's.
Mm.
That's what our food culture is. And so is there a reason why America leads the world in chronic non-infectious diseases? We invented glyphosate. We invented McDonald's. We invented some things that have not been very, very good for us.
And so for moving towards a more sustainable, healthy way of eating, that mind-gut connection, you wrote a book called Polyface Micro. And the idea is taking the Polyface Farms model and making it more attainable for families. How does that work?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, our first, 10, 12 years here, we were basically a glorified homestead. I mean, we had a fairly large acreage, but we weren't, it wasn't a business. We weren't making any money. We were basically feeding ourselves, but it was an experimental time. It was a time of discovery and experimentation. And then when I came back to the farm in 1982, we had to scale up because Teresa and I wanted to make a living here. And so you got to make a salary. You've got to, right? And so, it grew and grew and grew. And what's happened today, if you have your ear to the ground at all, you know that there is an exodus. There is an exodus occurring today from city to country as people buy up small acreages, urban farming, their backyard chickens. In 2020, 1 million backyard chicken flocks started in America in 2020. And so there's just when store shelves went empty, there's just this massive interest in doing something for myself, even if I live in a Manhattan apartment. So as I've responded, my books, I've always written responding to questions to the kind of, the big need of the hour. What am I hearing? Once 2019, 2020 hit, everything I was hearing was about, okay, I get what you're doing, but I don't have 100 acres. I've got two. I've got a backyard. I've got a city lot. What do I do there? And so I wrote Polyface Micro in order to, in 2021, in direct response to that scaling down of what we did. So, so everything is about how to have two cows, you know, five sheep, 10 chickens. All right. And to a miniature scale. And it's been extremely well received. And you know, it's all about empowering folks to be able to, you know, to do some for themselves and to fund their own empowerment. And the amazing thing is that as you start down that kind of physical provenance road, all sorts of neat things happen mentally and spiritually as you start immersing yourself in the majesty of nature in a very visceral, practical way.
It feels like in some ways it's not just about sustainable farming or regenerative growing practices, but it's almost a salvation for the spirit that you're talking about, a reconnection of the soul or the person to the land.
Well, it is, because, you know, fear not only affects us physically. Holistic doctors, we'll just call it holistic doctors, will say that the number one suppressant of an immune system is fear. Mm-hmm. And listen, when we had the black swans between, you know, the COVID and then the empty store shelves and then Putin invades Ukraine and cities are burning down and shoplifting and crime and you know, there's a lot of things to be fearful about. And so what happens, Elizabeth, as I think fear moves us, you know, you want to move away, right? When fear happens, I want a different place, but fear does not sustain us. Only faith sustains us. So what we're seeing is people are in fear, are wanting to move, but if they want to stay there, they have to embrace something. And the embracing is the backyard flock of chickens, the garden, the hanging herbal, the sourdough mother on the windowsill, you know, the alfalfa sprouts in the quart jar, you know, that becomes an embrace. And so you can't live your whole life running. At some point, you have to stop running and build and build a better thing. And so what I'm seeing is people are cashing in, you know, retirement pensions. They're cashing in even urban homes and replacing it with going to a place where they are physically proximate to people who know how to grow things, fix things, and build things. I call it the ultimate 401k. The ultimate 401k is not Wall Street. It's knowing how or being close to people who know how to fix things, grow things, and build things. That is becoming more valuable in our life. Why? Because ultimately, we don't want to live in fear. We don't want to live in worry. We don't want to live in anger and all that. Eventually, we want to take all those fears and all those worries, flip them upside down, embrace solutions to them, so that when society becomes hopeless and helpless, we can offer hope and help. That's what nourishes the human spirit.
It's so true. And it's interesting that you talked about fix things, build things, grow things, because I do a lot of work in rites of passage, coming of age ceremonies for young people and college students. And I have five things that I want young people to learn to do in order to maintain their mental health. And it's grow things, build things, fix things, make things, and love things. And it's those five pieces to sustainable mental health. So it sounds like we're aligned in what that looks like.
So wow, I'm curious, that we are. Yeah.
And so I'm curious to know when you, I know. And so clearly it's not just you and I, right? There's a collective understanding that those simple skill sets are really our key to sustainability as human beings moving into the future. That if we have the capacity to build things, grow things, fix things, love things, and make things, we have a sense of self-worth and esteem that gives us a groundedness. And so I'm curious to know, in your latest book, Homestead Tsunami, I think you touch on a lot of those skills, correct? Right.
Yes, I do. And so Polyface Micro is a very practical how-to. How do we have a small flock of chickens? How do we have a milk cow? How do we do these kinds of things? And what I started encountering, again, I'm responding to needs, and I started encountering three kinds of people. The first kind were the people that are on the fence. They're, oh man, we're in the city. Can we actually make this leap? You know, can we make this change? And then you have all their friends and family who think they're even crazy to consider going a place where Papa John's doesn't make automatic pizza deliveries, right? And they're, you know, they're throwing cold water on their relatives or friends and meaning well doing it. And then the third person are the people who did jump a year, two, three ago. They came to this homestead or this more self-reliant thing with all sorts of, you know, dreams and fantasies in their heads. But guess what? You know, the cow got mastitis, the cucumbers got powdery mildew, and the neighbor's dog just ate 10 chickens, and they're discouraged. And they need to find their first love. So I realized, boy, I need to bolster the practical how-to with an affirmation of why. Why would you grow a garden? Why would you can you know, tomatoes? Why would you make applesauce when you can go, you know, why would you buy a bushel of apples and can your own applesauce when you can go to the store and, you know, and buy it? And what I started realizing was that self-worth and personal affirmation, we saw it in our own kids, you know. Our daughter Rachel started baking pound cake and zucchini bread early, like she was 6 or 7 years old, and she was selling these, and ladies would buy them to serve for their like garden club or whatever, and so they'd come to farmers market, and here she is, you know, 7, 8 years old, and you know how ladies are, and these were, you know, sophisticated, you know, nice blue hair ladies, and oh, you're the girl that made the, you know, the pound cake I served for my ladies, and they thought it was the most wonderful thing. You know what that does to self-worth? And our problem is in our modern culture, we have screened, we have gone to social media and screen and done an absolute injustice and abuse to our children by denying them actual meaningful work. How do you determine who you are? What you are, what you love, what you're good at, your personhood is wrapped up in meaningful and accomplishing meaningful tasks. It doesn't happen when a parent pats you on the head and says you're a good little boy, you're a good little girl. As important as that may be, what we understand even as very, very little children is that accomplishing meaningful tasks brings our needfulness to society. And when we look at the fentanyl epidemic and the suicide rate and the depression, my goodness, you know way more about this than I do. But what I'm reading, you can confirm or deny, but what I'm reading is that a lot of that is fueled by a personal identity lostness that never occurred because I never accomplished anything valuable. And so that's why children's gardens, gathering eggs, cooking in the kitchen, making a dish, doing visceral, practical things, develop a mental health beyond all the focus groups and the, you know, the self-help sessions that you can imagine. It really is a very physical, mental relationship, just like we now know the relationship with our gut microbiome and our mental health and the soil and our mud. It's not segregated. It's fundamentally integrated.
I agree. My guest today is Joel Salatin from Polyface Farm, and you can find out all about Polyface Farms by visiting their website or find them on Instagram as well. And Joel, you know, it's so interesting that you're talking about children and chores and work, because there's a lot of research that shows that children from very young ages, around 3 years old, 4 years old, they want to help. They want to help fold the laundry or help make the bed or help in the kitchen. And a lot of parents are just so busy with life, you know, it's quicker for them just to do it themselves. And they're like, no, I'll just do it. Or the kids are in preschool. But there's this window of time that if you can get kids involved feeling like they're part of the family, they naturally grow that self-esteem and continued helping in the work ethic. But if you don't involve kids from a very young age, it's hard when they're 12, 13, 14, 15 to then instill that value system. And so a lot of parents think that, oh, the kids are so young, they can't do anything. But that's absolutely when they need to start feeling like they have a chore or a place or a purpose in the family. So you've tapped into that in such a profound way. And then you said something about like a children's garden. And I'm wondering what that looks like. If you're someone in an apartment, it may be as simple as just a box that the kids can throw some seeds in and tend. I'm wondering if that's something that would be a good start for a family.
Yeah. Well, this helps a child viscerally interact with the world that's bigger than them. Mm-hmm. And so it could be something as simple as a vermicomposting kit. You can buy a little 12-inch vermicomposting, with worms under your sink. Feed them your kitchen scraps. In my book, Polyface Micro, I talk about how to have chickens and rabbits in a Manhattan apartment on a footprint the size of a regular entertainment center. People have pet dogs, they have pet cats, and I'm not against dogs and cats, but how about having two chickens that eat your kitchen scraps and give you eggs and wake up early in the morning and they're always happy and they offer unconditional love. You know, my animals and my tomato plants, they're always glad to see me. They never say negative. They never say your ears are big. They never say, you know, you walk funny. They're always glad to see you. And they need us. The tomato plants need us. The chickens need us. They need us to feed them. They need us to do things. And so that feeling of needfulness and the reciprocated unconditional acceptance is truly profound. And so I'll just say one of the reasons why there is a homestead tsunami is because it is more difficult in an apartment, you know, and let's just admit it. But so when you get out and you're actually interacting with plants and animals, you are actually spending time with things that are bigger than you. You know, one of the problems with video games is that I'm in control all the time. And I can turn it off. I can turn it on. Goodness, if I run my car off the road and my little, you know, avatar gets killed, the game gives me a new avatar. Listen, you know, when you're growing things and the tomato plant dies, the garden doesn't give you another tomato plant. And children need to encounter failure like that. They need to encounter little, I call it the vaccination of death, you know, little things, little encounters like that, to understand that life is bigger than me. It's better. It's better than me and it's best. And it's unbelievably bad and it's worst, but I'm all a part of it. And so encountering in very practical, visceral ways, this world that's bigger than me creates humility rather than hubris. And goodness knows our culture needs more humility and a little less hubris.
Well, and then to go back to what you were saying about fear, you know, if children are able to see life and death in process from plants and animals from a very young age, then the fear of death becomes less, I would think, as the children grow. And so in our last minute, Joel, I would imagine you have a lot you want to accomplish and your son Daniel is also a part of it. What is your hope for the next phase of Polyface Farms?
Well, I guess our best hope. Yeah, I guess our best hope is that we continue to attract young people who love the land as much as we do, who love nutrition and healthy patrons. We call them our patron saints. We try not to call them customers. They're our patron saints, and we want to love them. We want our team to love them as much as I do. And so just a continued platforming, if you will, of additional team of diversified passion and talent and skill level young people who will take this to the next generation. It's way bigger than I am, way bigger than Daniel is now. And I don't mean like we're an empire builder. I mean, we just can't run this all. And we never had a business plan. We never said we want X number of customers. We've just tried to take care of people, love people, produce, be faithful to the land. And here it is. And so it's a great, you know, it's a great object lesson of just sacred mission-driven purpose. And boy, sacred mission-driven purpose is something that every single person in the world, if you don't have it, you need to get in a room, and if you got to get in a yoga pose, that's fine. I don't care how you do it, but get with yourself and start asking things. You know, what's a purpose that's bigger than my life? What's my legacy? What do I want said at my eulogy? What do I want my kids to say about me? What do I want others to say? Those are really powerful legacy, purpose-driven things.
Joel Salatin, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom. And if people want to interface with Polyface, they go to polyface.com to find your website.
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you so much. And thank you for spending this hour tuning in and listening to and supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. We'll be back next week, Tuesday at 2, to continue the conversation.
Talk about an uphill battle, 2,000 acres of beans and cattle. But he don't ever get a rattle. He just goes till the sun goes down.